From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Is the internet the great leveler, the technological advance that makes David the new Goliath? Does the internet mean the end of big? Well, Niccolo Melese thinks so. He's written a book called The End of Big. He was a webmaster for Governor Howard Dean's 2004 presidential bid. And since then, he's become an entrepreneur, an angel investor, and a business consultant on the digital age. Niccolo Melese is also on the faculty of the Harvard Kennedy School, where he teaches graduate-level classes on the internet and politics. And he joins us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, Ross.
I have to ask you today, how's the Boston area in the wake of yesterday's marathon bombing? It must still be a shockwave sweeping through your city.
It is. It's still a sad time here in Boston. Everyone is concerned and worried about each other and worried about the victims still in the hospital.
You know, we're going to be talking in a moment about your take on radical connectivity nurtured by digital media. Did you see any examples in the reaction to yesterday's horrifying events that kind of go towards what you're trying to say about this radical connectivity?
Absolutely. A lot of what happened yesterday, many people around the country, around the world, were following the breaking story on Twitter and on Facebook. They weren't looking to some of the more traditional sources of news. In fact, the Boston Globe's website had trouble staying up, and people were going to social networks to find out what the latest was, to try and track down loved ones, to talk to each other. And that had both very positive things and some very negative things. On the one hand, there was a lot of it was easy to get information. There was a lot of sharing. There was an impressive Google spreadsheet of people volunteering to let marathoners stay in their homes. But by the same token, there was a lot of misinformation spread, a lot of rumors that simply weren't true, fake photos even that were shared.
I mean,
so one of the concerns of that I try and address in my book is when everyone has a smartphone that's connected to the internet, that's a tremendous redistribution of power, and that wreaks havoc on many of the traditional institutions of our democracy.
And it also, of course, establishes the fact that trust becomes extremely important in a situation like that when there are so many different voices out there. Who do you trust?
That's right. I mean, one of the things we're dealing with in the end of big era is the end of big expertise, the end of big knowledge. Figuring out who's in charge and what's true can be very challenging, especially for some of the larger media institutions.
Well, one of your core points here, radical connectivity is toxic to the conventional power structures. Talk a little bit more about that. How is it toxic? And give some examples.
Sure. I mean, part of the problem actually is we don't have good language to talk about what's going on. Digital doesn't quite capture it. The internet doesn't quite capture it. Mobile phones, that's not the right word. So I tried to coin a term, radical connectivity, to describe what I think is really going on, which is a tremendous power shift from institutions to individuals. A Cray supercomputer in 1969 cost $5 million and would have filled an auditorium, and it was really only available to the biggest universities, companies, and governments in the world. Today, your iPhone 4 is approximately the same power as one of those Cray supercomputers. Two-thirds of Americans are walking around with smartphones, and a huge percentage of the world, in fact, is walking around with these smartphones. And so this power that used to be really reserved for large institutions has been pushed, distributed to everyday individuals all over. And that's really causing a real challenge for our institutions. If you look at a good example, we just talked about the press. Another good example is to look at what's happening in the political parties, where outsider insurgent candidates are able to use the internet to raise money to be competitive with the establishment. You know, the notion that Barack Obama would defeat Hillary Clinton in 2007 is unimaginable. That a man who'd been in public life less than a decade would defeat Bill and Hillary Clinton, who built the modern Democratic Party. Especially the last couple of cycles, we look at the role of the Tea Party candidates in Senate races, defeating establishment candidates. But I'm not just interested in the institutions of democracy. I'm also interested in the impact this has on on the entertainment industry.
Well, also, you know, I'm thinking of your institution, Harvard University. Yeah. Is radical connectivity undermining the power structure at the university? Is it we're seeing online courses, et cetera, out there? Is that toxic to universities?
Absolutely. You know, the cost of a four-year college education has skyrocketed, and the earning power it confers has plummeted. And at the same time, people are looking around at alternative opportunities to get educated online. I'm not suggesting that an online education completely replaces, you know, the in-classroom experience. I'm a teacher. I love the classroom. But there's a real transfer of power going on here. Sebastian Thrun, who was one of the most popular professors at Stanford, famous tenured professor at Stanford, left Stanford to teach online because he said, would I rather teach 150 students or 150,000?
Well, this makes me wonder, Nicol Mallee is my guest. We're talking about The End of Big, his new book about how the internet makes David the new Goliath. I'm wondering if this plays out differently at elite institutions like Harvard versus other institutions that don't have such a rarefied atmosphere. Could it actually boost the power of a conventional power structure at a place like Harvard because it has that brand name and can bring it online in the courses, but undermines the conventional power structure at institutions that don't have such a heralded reputation?
Well, I'm not sure how much the reputation counts in the internet era. I think individual reputations matter. I think the power that individuals bring, the way they cultivate their own brands and their own expertise online, I think that matters a lot. But in terms of institutional power, I'm not sure. I don't believe it's going to carry the same weight that it has in the past.
Nico, a lot of people dance around the question of, is technology good? Is technology bad? You say flatly, technology seems value neutral, yet it isn't. So what are the values there?
I believe that technology carries a profound value, the profound individual power as a value system. Then a lot of the systems of our technology today, from the internet to our mobile phones, are designed to push power to the individual. Is that good? Sometimes. Is that bad? Yeah, sometimes that's bad.
So is technology innately libertarian?
Well, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it libertarian. I mean, you can do a wide range of things with technology. You can organize all kinds of sharing, you know, collaborative consumption, free cycle, barter card. There's a whole range of websites and web services and mobile apps designed to let people share things in a way that is more communitarian than libertarian. It's a mix of ideologies that come into play when we're talking about this profound individual empowerment that technology provides. That's why the subtitle of the book is, you know, David is the new Goliath. Yeah. That the power that individuals carry is really tremendous in this day and age.
If you've got a response or a question for Nicol Mallee about these provocative ideas, give me a call, 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. It's toll-free, 800-289-5869. Or write to us, conversation@kuow.org. Another line in the book that jumped out at me, technology's nonpartisan political philosophy can be summarized in one 1960s phrase, burn it all down and make me some money. Could you unpack that for us?
Sure. One of the things I talk about in the first chapter of the book is some of the history of the technology and where it comes from. Most of the architects of the modern era of mobile phones and the internet grew up on college campuses in the United States in the 60s and 70s, and they encountered a time of profound change and a time of really profound anti-establishment sentiment. From the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement, there was this dramatic sense that we were not being well served by our institutions. And you can see, you can trace that thread through a range of marketing and slogans and approaches to the technology. But then it hits the IPO era and wanting to take technology companies public, and gets mixed up with a desire, with kind of monopolistic desire to make money on the part of these large companies. It's the end of traditional big institutions, but at the same time, it's the rise of the even bigger. There are essentially six companies that control our online life: Amazon, Apple, eBay, Microsoft, Google, and Facebook.
So should the subtitle of your book, The End of Big, been The Beginning of Bigger?
The next book will be The Rise of the Even Bigger. See, we have to start somewhere.
Okay. I want to bore down a little bit more on this. Is it true that radical connectivity is toxic to all aspects of old institutions? And as you inferred there, certainly not with business. And I'm thinking of The Economist, which recently reported on how Chinese authoritarian rule has not only survived the internet, but the state has shown great skill in bending the technology to its own purposes, enabling it to exercise better control of its own society and setting an example for other repressive regimes. Does it reinforce big when it comes to authoritarian regimes?
I think it's a mixed bag even there, that if you look at China, I actually talk about this in the book to some extent, China's really struggled in many ways without traditional way institutions and ways of creating accountability and justice. When people feel wronged by the government, when they encounter a corrupt official, when they feel like due process has been denied, they turn to social media. And sometimes it's really dangerous what happens. The New York Times profiled something called the human flesh search engine, which is if you see someone doing something illegal and you don't believe they'll get justice, take a picture of it, put their picture on the internet, and then everybody, let's hunt them down. You know, there's a kind of vigilante justice that is almost beyond the ability of the government to entirely control. And so I do think authoritarian regimes are constantly looking for ways to take advantage of this technology, but I don't believe in the end it's going to work out for them. The technology just is really pushes power down to individuals in such a profound way. It's very hard for them to control that in every single citizen.
But in some ways, it reinforces the power. And we talked about China just a moment ago. But the Obama White House has successfully used social media to bring their message directly to the people to avoid going through reporters. In fact, a photo of the Obamas hugging released on Election Day 2012 was the world's most popular tweet on Twitter. Now, on the one hand, it's just an affectionate, nice photo. It was taken well before the election took place. But there are some who say that the people in power, in political power, even in this country, are able to so effectively use social media that it increases their power rather than diffuses it to others.
Well, there's a complicated power is changing in some complicated ways we don't entirely understand. There's no doubt that it is changing the nature of the executive branch. Whitehouse.gov is now got almost as much traffic as some major media news outlets. Many days it has more traffic than MSNBC.com. And so Whitehouse.gov, they have a whole team of people covering the federal government. They make videos. It's more Whitehouse.gov is more like a news site than it is anything else. And for the most part, that's really good. Arguably, the federal government is more accessible to the American people thanks to Whitehouse.gov than it's ever been before.
Well, I would go along with that
in American history.
But I would go along with that, but you said it's like a news site. But a news site would not be so unquestioningly praising and always looking at the bright side of what the administration does, regardless of what you think about it. Imagine another administration in power.
Sure.
I mean, it's not like a news site at all, is it?
Well, it's not like a news site in the sense of there's not going to be hard-hitting investigative reporting. I just mean to say it's not dry press releases
sure.
and dry government reports. It's really pretty engaging content, a real sense of what's going on. Now, a fair bit of it doesn't really get much traction because it can get very policy wonky. But some of it is I think, a pretty compelling view of what the federal government happens, what's happening in cabinet agencies. Now, at the same time, you just mentioned this. You could imagine that kind of concentrated power in the executive branch being abused. That's not hard to imagine in many ways.
Well, actually,
I think that the
Obama administration's use of it. And I'm being tough on this because certainly in the stimulus package that came out, billions of dollars being spent, a very transparent process, in part because the White House wanted to make sure that you could look and see where that money was being spent in all those different areas. But I'm kind of wondering whether this is really marketing at some level masquerading as news, marketing of the image and the qualities of this political president.
There's no doubt that some of it is spin. I, in my assessment of it, am generally impressed by how much of it is actually is real and worthwhile. But there is always a danger in kind of the spin culture we live in that it can become marketing and not government serving the people. And it's up to us as citizens to really demand more of that, to demand that kind of accountability.
Well, the era of radical connectivity is still rapidly changing and turning over. Nico Malee, where do you see it going in the future? There's lots of speculation of where we might be practicing this radical connectivity, and it's certainly not settled down even technologically. Where do you see us heading?
The pace of change is pretty impressive. One of the places I believe it's heading is actually to physical things. As part of my quote-unquote research, I bought a 3D printer. And I printed an iPhone case, practicing, seeing if I can print shoes for my boys, two little boys, ages 4 and 2, imagining what happens if imagining what the world might look like if everybody has a 3D printer in their house and can print. Just you could take a picture of a friend's coffee table and then send it home to your printer, and your printer prints it. And that has significant implications for manufacturing, for big box retail, for the future of big companies and big brands. And so I think that's a major area where the next 15, 20 years is going to have some significant implications at the end of big and that kind of power.
And you'll be able to make a gun. No background check required.
That's right. I mean, this gets down to the fundamental empowerment of the individual. If you have an internet connection and a good 3D printer, you can print a gun. A guy in Texas did already. Not just any gun. He printed the pieces of an assault rifle, a semi-automatic machine gun.
Well, I was scheduled to interview the author of a book called The End of Sex this week, and I'm talking to you today about your book, The End of Big. So the Washington Post—
Not as interesting as The End of Sex.
but the interesting about it, the Washington Post wrote, The End of Everything. Everyone is delivering the end of something. And the story said, The End of is a perfect headline for our age. It fits the moment that fetishizes disruption over stability. It grabs an audience enamored of what is next, not what is here. It suits a public debate, which is extreme positions are requisite starting points, end quote. I'm wondering what you think about that.
I think the reason we have all these books titled The End of, insert here, is that there is actually a profound change going on in our economy, in our society, in our culture, in our institutions. Technology's disrupted so much. It's changed so many of the assumptions we have about power and the way things work. This really is a significant transitional time in American history and arguably in human history. If you look at the effect of the Industrial Revolution, if you look at, King Edward VII's funeral in 1910, most of the nations that sent representatives were monarchies or colonies of monarchies in 1910. And 100 years later, that world is gone. And any of the people who went to King Edward VII's funeral would not recognize our age today. And I think we're in a similar, fairly dramatic period of transformation as power is realigned.
Nico Malee, I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been great.
He's been talking to us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he is on the faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School. His book is called The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Speaking of David, David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Hannah Byrne and Cameron Drews. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds.